Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the game. The Premier League returns. We pick our teams and players of the season who will astound and amaze. Which clubs will be left in turmoil? We'll also reflect on Chelsea's Super Cup win and ask if Manchester United have closed the gap to their local rivals, Manchester City. I'm Hugh Wisencroft and this is the game. So it's time to whet the appetite for the new season ahead with our picks and predictions for the Premier League. To help me through it all, Gregor Robertson, Jonathan Northcroft, and for the first part of the podcast, Tom Roddy, who joins us after the Super Cup in Belfast. How are you all?
Morning, Hugh.
Very good.
Good. See, this is starting off good this season with the hellos, and it will slowly descend to silence within the next few weeks. So, you know, good for me, but you know, just keep it up. That's all I'm asking. In fact, we've all had a good summer, hopefully. We're all refreshed and ready to go for the new season ahead. Unlikely, actually, for those of us that were working on the Euros. But in terms of the players and the clubs, some are in a better position than others, and maybe that is because of the Euros and all the players coming back a little bit late. So I'm going to start this first section of the pod by looking ahead to the new season, asking you who had the best summer, which players to watch out for, who we think will be over and underachievers in the Premier League this season. And I'll start with you, Gregor. Who do you think had the best summer?
I think Aston Villa. And that may sound really weird when they've just sold their absolute talisman to Jack Grealish. But I think Emi Buendia is a star. The arrival of Danny Ings opens up so many avenues and options. Ollie Watkins, until 2 years ago, was a wide forward. And alleviates the pressure on him and it opens up a lot more options. And Leon Bailey is another option up front. So the options they have going forward are already on a solid foundation. I think Aston Villa have recruited really well compared to most teams. I think we'll probably come to them. I think the most interesting summer is Crystal Palace. But I think the best summer in terms of transfer dealings is Aston Villa.
I agree. I've picked Aston Villa as my team that had the best summer. You know, Jack Grealish, I think, is a miss. But as that video from Christian Perslow suggested, you know, there's a bit of money ball going on here and some shrewd recruitment and acquisitions. And I think they're well set to actually improve without Jack Grealish in the team. Is that what you were going to say, Tom?
Yeah. Funnily enough, it is. And also, I still think £100 million is a hell of a lot of money for Jack Grealish. He's a very good player and was a game changer. And if you were Aston Villa, you want that amount of money to let him go from your club. But it's still a ridiculous amount of money. So that deal and the replacements that they were able to bring in together, I think they've so far, and we'll see whether it turns out that way, but it feels this summer like they've just worked on this pretty perfectly, really. And of course, you know, Danny Ings was always that. He was that striker who wasn't quite on the top level, but you didn't know where he'd end up. And so for Villa to get him through the door, it was really impressive, to be honest. I do think as well, United are interesting, aren't they? You would have liked to have seen a striker in there, but keeping hold of Cavani does the job for now as Greenwood develops. And Ferran and Sancho should be working alongside Maguire and adding to that attack. they really should be a contender this season.
One more thing on Villa, I don't think they're finished either. They are like a rising force. They've got their owners, Nassif Sawari and Wes Edens, combined make them the third richest owners in the Premier League. Villa have got a pretty bright future under them, and I'm not sure they're finished this summer either. So, you know, they showed their intent by trying to buy Smith Rowe from Arsenal and whatnot. You know, that seemed very bold, but it showed their intent. Yeah, I think Aston Villa are a rising force.
Yeah, with Axel Tuanzebe there on loan as well, bolstered the defence too, and I'm sure there'll be more to come through the door. Have you picked, Johnny, either United or Aston Villa, or have you got someone else for us?
I can't disagree with those picks. They were what I was going to say. And Villa are interesting because you speak to people around the Premier League, and they are the one that other clubs are keeping an eye on, and you know, saying they've done well, and. You know, they could be the rising force. There's a lot of people looking at Villa. The recruitment's been good. I think Buendia's a sensational signing, and I agree on Danny Ings. It's just a superb deal. But you can't lose sight of the fact they've lost Grealish. They mitigated it well. But I am a bit cautious about picking them as having the best summer, because I think they've recruited the best, but they have lost. You know, it's like Crystal Palace losing Zaha, and Palace are another who are recruiting really well. But, you know, will they keep Zaha? You've got to remember the impact of great players going, and not just look at what's coming in the door. We saw that with Spurs and Gareth Bale all that time ago. United, Hugh, come on. I mean, you've got to be happy with Sancho and Varane. Of all the big clubs, they've done probably the best business, and they've done what we've said Ed Woodward should have done for the last, I don't know, 5-6 windows, summers. Targeted top class recruitment. I mean, you must be optimistic about that.
Listen, you know, for me, top four is the minimum. Top four is the minimum for me. I know a lot of people are saying Man United have to challenge, but I'm one of those. You know, a Manchester United fan who doesn't think there's a divine right to win trophies. You really have to earn it out on the pitch. And the competitors are very, very good. I think they're in the conversation. They should always be in the conversation, frankly, given the money that they've spent. But the players that they've brought in now to go with the money, the actual talent, is probably a very good summer for them. But I look at the way that Chelsea ended last season, and I still think they're dangerous, especially if they sign Lukaku. We know how good Manchester City are. Van Dijk, Gomez, a new centre-back in the shape of Ibrahima Konate at Liverpool as well. They might be a totally refreshed side going into the season. So, you know, I'm happy with Manchester United. I'm pleased with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. You can quote me on this, you know, given the improvements that were made last year. But as I've said previously, Manchester United need to become a dominant side, not play counter-attack. You know, they've got the players to do that. We understand, but they need to really control games if they're to keep up with a City or a Liverpool or a Chelsea who clearly do on their day. So look, I'm happy and encouraged, but I don't think they'll win the league. So if they do, I'll be absolutely delighted. So yeah, keeping my streak of negativity up, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
Exactly. A little bit of optimism with a big dollop of I get you. But I was going to say, I mean, I think the answer to the question really actually would be Chelsea for me. I think if they get Lukaku, it is the one missing piece. They did end last season with that fantastic run and Champions League final. The Super Cup's significant for them. You know, it's something they hadn't won. It keeps that rolling. If you want to factor in the summer, you factor in the Euros, what Jorginho did, his growth and stature. And Kai Havertz showed all the signs that he was beginning to show at the end of last season. That I think it's going to be a massive season for him. And they're the ones that have just sort of, you know, yes, City are recruiting well, but if you talk about targeted recruitment, I think Lukaku in that Chelsea team almost trumps everything that anyone else has done.
If they get Jules Koundé from Sevilla as well, a big link, would be a massive acquisition too, yeah. Look, let's talk about our players to watch in the upcoming season, Aston Villa or otherwise. Villa fans already delighted with our start to the podcast. Tom Roddy, who are you looking out for?
We saw him sort of emerge out of the shadow of Jota last season. I'm really interested to see how Pedro Neto develops this year, trying to go ever so slightly left field rather than the kind of obvious contenders. But I just think he is someone who could end up being following Jota, really. I think he has similar qualities, and Wolves are probably one of two clubs who are a real, two or three clubs who are real unknown this year about how they're going to perform with the change of manager. But I think he'll be one who, just the way he plays, the clever runs he makes, he's a great finisher. It could be not his breakthrough year, obviously, because he's already done that, but just going up another level. And one other, just to kind of go for someone breaking through with Arsenal, I think they're going to have a tough year, but there will be, again, similar to last year, players who will have individually very impressive campaigns, like Smith Rowe did last year, like Saka did last year, and Tierney. And in the same way Smith Rowe broke through and had an absolutely excellent season, I think we could see, you know, there's so much excitement around Balogun, and I think he'll get his opportunity this year, and I think he'll take it.
Gregor, what do you think? Who are you looking out for?
Michael Olise at Crystal Palace. He was one of the most entertaining players I've seen in the Championship for many a year. He scored 7 goals and got 12 assists in the Championship last year. He's 19. He's like one of these players that he's so unpredictable, and so he's got pace and technique. He can run, you know, one of them, he looks quicker with the ball when he's running with the ball, but he's got a little trick. He kind of plays a little bit of swagger as well for someone so young. He's a real talent. And I think it was 8 million. I think he may have had a buyout clause in his contract. That could prove to be an absolute bargain. I think he might miss the opening weeks of the season. I think he's got an injury, but he is someone that is definitely worth keeping an eye out for. Huge talent.
Yeah, some interesting players coming in. That's a good couple of good picks. I mean, Junior Firpo at Leeds, and you think of his pedigree and what Bielsa is able to get from that type of player. Brian Hill, who I must admit I haven't seen too much of, but in clips looks incredible, and those who've watched him in Spain say he's going to really entertain people. And Lokonga is quite a good signing at Arsenal. Daka at Leicester. There's, as usual, there's a good sort of stream of, you know, interested players from abroad. I suppose I'm going to be a bit kind of tartan here and pick Billy Gilmore, though. I just think I think the level.
Nothing wrong with that.
Thanks. I thought you'd like that. I just think it's, you know, Norwich have made one of the best signings of anyone in getting Gilmore. He'll get his chance there. He'll get an opportunity to play a full Premier League season. And at the Euros, we saw the level that he's already at. I think this will be a great development year for him, and he'll go back to Chelsea as the real heir to Jorginho and probably be in the team next year.
I mean, I'm just going to pick Jadon Sancho, just because so many people who have watched him in Germany were so shocked that he wasn't starting every single game for England at the Euros, which means he must have something special and something to prove as well back in Manchester. So look, I think, hopefully, for Man United fans, he has a good season, and for England fans too, as well. Let's quickly move to our overachievers this year. Who do you think is going to surpass expectation? Johnny, I'll start with you on this one.
It's always Leicester, and they'll do it again. They've recruited well. I mean, Fofana's injuries is a bit of a blow for them, but you know, they'll get Vestergaard or someone else good. They'll be right up among the top four or five, and you take a step back, that is an overachievement.
You can't really say they're overachieving again, because obviously that would be entirely expected, wouldn't it? So
yeah.
It's very much not an overachievement, but rather a same old. So I appreciate you like Leicester, Johnny. Let's
get away. Thank you. Leicester and Billy Gilmore. I've just started in such predictable vein, haven't I?
Tom, what do you think? Overachievers.
I think I mentioned the teams that are real unknowns this year. And one of them is Brentford, but I'm still going to pick them as an overachiever, because there's not a huge expectation about them. And I think the three teams coming up, as usual, are tipped to go down. I think they'll do what a lot of teams that come up and take that kind of momentum and that fearlessness. And in Thomas Frank, they have a real sort of identity and leadership. And with Ivan Toney up front, I mean, he's going to cause a lot of defenders some problems. The only pity about Brentford is I remember seeing last year, and and in the year before that, Josh De Silva playing, and have thought he's a Premier League quality player. And there's no surprise that he spent time at Arsenal as a youngster. It's a pity that he won't be involved for quite a bit of the season, at least. But yeah, I can see them doing well.
I think Brentford, I have them down as one of my overachievers because I think their style of football lends itself really well to the Premier League, where it's maybe a little bit more tactical. However, a lot of their players are technically very good. It's just the level of intensity. It might take them a few weeks. I still think they'll be overachievers, but I think they might be a surprise in the first few weeks of the season that they don't play as well as maybe we expect, because a lot of their players' style is to, you know, get the ball, have a look up, great passes, technically good. You know, the system works very, very well. But I think it might take them a couple of weeks just to get the level of, oh, we do have to play 100 miles an hour for most of the game in the Premier League, you know, instead of just 15 or 20 minutes, score a couple of goals, and then we can just pass it around. So, you know, it will be a slight shell shock for most of their players, but I do think they can have a good season. I think Brighton, for me, could be overachievers. They're the team that I've picked. They just need to put the ball in the back of the net, not change much, sign a decent striker. You know, hardest thing to do in the game, put the ball in the back of the net. We all know that. But I think if they can get a goal scorer, they probably, for me, will be in the top half. So I'll choose Brighton as mine. Gregor, yours?
Apart from the obvious in Burnley, who like will just continue to do what Burnley do, I think Norwich. I think it probably will be a surprise to many because of the kind of humiliating way that they were relegated last season. They lost their last, 2 years ago, they lost their last 10 games. They conceded 75 goals. They were like labelled naive because they kept trying to play it from the back, and they only spent £5 million on like an up and coming left back from Coventry. So yeah, everyone thought, well, are we not going to try? And then this summer, they will have spent, I think, over £50 million, which is still not in Premier League terms enormous, but I think the last time they spent more than £8 million until this season was on Pritchard from Spurs in 2016. So they have really cut their cloth accordingly, and this is kind of part of the plan. It's like, if we get up, we might come back down, but the next time we go up, we'll be in better shape. And they have, you know, although they've lost Buendia, they've signed two forwards from Werder Bremen, they've just signed a winger from Greece, and they signed a left back and Ben Gibson, two defenders, were on loan last season. And the most important thing is their defence is already much better. They were, I think, because he conceded 36 goals last season, which only Watford bettered. And even when they came up, what would that have been now? 3 years ago, they could still conceded like 50-something goals. They've been really poor at the back all the way through Farke's kind of tenure, but they played great football and they scored goals. He's kind of done something to tweak it a bit and shore up the defence. And I think that might be enough for them. Other players who we know, Max Ahrens, Cantwell, you know, older, wiser, they've been here before, bit of experience. I think Norwich might surprise a few.
Listen, that was just a long-winded Billy Gilmore shout, by the way. So,
yes.
Yeah, I know you didn't mention him, but I know what you meant, Gregor Robertson. So don't think you can hide it from me.
We knew.
underachievers of the season. Johnny, I'll start with you on this again.
Arsenal, maybe Spurs. Look, I think Arsenal are starting to go in the right direction. It's just a big tanker that they're trying to turn around. But I think the recruitment's changing. Quite clever. The building around Saka and Smith Rowe and the right types of players. But I still think they're a long way away. I think their objective is to challenge for the top six, really, which is sensible to try and do it in stages. But when you think of the scale of that club and the money that's been spent since, you know, like 5-6 years, it's an underachievement to be where they are. I'd say the same with Spurs. I think, I mean, they might just pay the price for a few years of mess, and regardless of whether Kane goes or stays, again signs some decent players. This looks like an end of a cycle at Spurs, and they could have to stomach some pain before coming back again. So I just think those two, you know, maybe this is coming back in the category of we expect them to underachieve or overachieve, whatever. So if you're looking for something unexpected, that might not be the answer. But in a kind of more big picture sense, I expect them to both be trying to get in the top six, while clubs like Leicester, maybe even Villa, and maybe even West Ham again are above them.
No, I picked those two as my underachievers, Arsenal and Spurs. I've just written outside top six. So that's pretty much where they are for me right now. Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, I would have gone the same for the exact same reasons Johnny said. To go for to mention a different club. And it's tricky in a way, Hugh, because the league... It is predictable at times, but only sort of certain sections in a way. Southampton have had such a difficult summer. There's not always huge expectation on them, but I worry with the way in which players have left there. I mean, they already had a bit of fragility last year mentally in that team, but to see the way in which players and key players like Bertrand, Ings have gone, and Vestergaard seems certainly to be on his way. It looks like a big job for Ralf Hasenhüttl this year to not be in a relegation battle. And they seem like the issue that they have is that they don't tend to be particularly sort of steady. They tend to have peaks and troughs, and the highs can be very high, you know, beating the champions of England last year, and the lows. I don't want to mention the nine goals conceded, but they can be so low. So if Southampton are in a relegation battle, then for them, that's underachieving.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that. I think Southampton are going to have a tough, tough season. And I think Ralf Hasenhüttl will be one of the first managers linked with whatever job becomes available, whether it's in this country or elsewhere. I think he might have to jump ship before things go down too far. Just finally on this, Gregor, your underachievers?
Everton, I think. They might still finish eighth or whatever, but they'll still be underachieving as a football club. They spent £500 million since the owner came in, and it's incredible to think how little they have to show for it. Rafa Benitez, when you talk about the atmosphere he's walking into, the group of players that really, a lot of whom they can't get off the wage bill. If they want to sell them, they're not going to raise much money. And they're having to sign Andros Townsend on a free, and Damari Gray could be a not bad signing for like less than £2 million. That's the kind of pool that they're fishing in at the moment. You know, who knows? They might finish eighth and Rafa will kind of grind them on to flirting with the top six or whatever. But it's still underachievement for Everton. And Everton is a huge football club, huge historic football club. And the way they've been run, it's just all coming home to roost. They're in danger of breaching profit and sustainability regulations as well. So Everton, I think, are a hugely underachieving football club.
Right, that's the verdict from Gregor Robertson and the rest of us as well. And we're going to predict a headline of the season a little bit later on to end the podcast. But up next, how will the new faces in the dugout fare in the Premier League? Remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. And make sure you're subscribed to The Times and The Sunday Times. You'll get yourself 1 month free if you do it right now. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/the game. There are a number of new managers in the Premier League. Some we know and love, some we've pretty much never heard of. So what should we expect from some of the new faces in the dugout in the Premier League? Let's start with Rafa Benitez, who we've mentioned already, of course, Champions League winner with Liverpool. 3-year deal he signed with Everton, as Gregor mentioned, only £1.5 million spent on Damari Gray, free transfers for Asmir Begovic and Andros Townsend. We know Gregor's view on this. What do you think, Johnny? Will Rafa Benitez struggle at Everton?
It's tough for Rafa, and I'm a big Rafa fan, but I just fear he's walked in at the most difficult of times where, you know, as lads have mentioned, the FFP concerns that Everton have. I think the nuance here is that PSG are doing what they're doing because UEFA have relaxed their regulations. But as I understand it, I think Everton have got to think about Premier League regulations, and they might not be as relaxed. So that, I think that is affecting them in the transfer market. He's also inheriting a squad where there's certain players that, you know, right up Rafa's street. Dominic Calvert-Lewin, I know he really likes Ben Godfrey. But he's, you know, James Rodriguez was somebody that exasperated him when he was Real Madrid manager, and I don't see a fit there. There's a sort of general lack of reliability about some of those players physically, as we've seen, and Rafa will try and demand a, you know, a physically intense game. So he's got a lot of problems to sort out, and that's before you look at the fan base and their antipathy towards him as a former Liverpool manager, and the politics of Everton themselves with their, you know, owner that quite likes getting involved in recruitment and sporting director who's got a checkered record, shall we say. It's a difficult time. It's a difficult time for Rafa. The only thing is, what I'm fascinated is how he'll interact with that fan base, because he has had a habit of being able to win fans over at most of his clubs. It didn't happen at Chelsea, but if he can harness them, you know, if he can harness Goodison Park, maybe he'll get himself time. As I say, this year he needs to buy himself time to sort that squad out, which will take him longer than, you know, this particular window, given the restrictions I talked about.
It's an interesting one. I do see Everton and Rafa Benitez in particular as one of those figures that can, you know, towards the end of the transfer window, pick up maybe a few loans or frees, you know, some people that he believes he can get something out of, maybe in the short term, 1, maybe 2 years, who could maybe help Everton out. I don't think it's the worst squad in the world. And I think for me, he's a manager who can get more than the sum of the parts out of a group of players. I'm hoping he's still got that magic touch. I do believe if things go right, they can make a top six push. But I believe Rafa's going to have to upset quite a few players in the squad to make that happen, because some of the big names are probably going to be the ones being left out if that's going to happen for me. But I am intrigued by it all for all the reasons you mentioned, Johnny. So I will be keeping a close eye on Everton this season. Let's speak about Patrick Vieira next. Of course, Arsenal's former Premier League winning captain. He signed a 3-year deal at Crystal Palace. He was criticised for a lack of a footballing philosophy while he was at Nice, sacked after losing his final five games. Mark Gahey, Joachim Anderson, Michael Olise, Conor Gallagher in at the club, amongst a few others as well, but those are the big names. Gregor, what are you expecting at Selhurst Park?
I think Palace have gone from being one of the most boring teams in the Premier League to perhaps the most interesting, just because of the scale of the kind of overhaul that they're having to, that they're going through really this summer. And it's, well, you know, a big part of this as well, their academy was granted Category 1 status last summer. Building new facilities for that. It is a pivot away from the oldest squad in the Premier League to perhaps one of the youngest. I understand 12 academy players went on their pre-season tour. Appointment of, I forget his name right, Saïd Aigoun from Paris Saint-Germain, who's like the development coach, kind of bridge the gap between the academy and the first team. That was someone that Vieira pushed for. And you know, that again suggests that this is the direction they're going in. And as you've reeled off the players, I think some really good signings. The Anderson was good at Fulham. Conor Gallagher is a player with a lot of potential. And Gahey, he was at Swansea last season. Watched him against Daryl Dike, you know, huge, powerful striker for Barnsley in the playoffs. And he was absolutely outstanding. He was the best player on the pitch, head and shoulders, and he's someone who's really highly rated. I'm not sure Chelsea really want to let him go, but you know, he's very highly thought of. So, you know, the thing that's kind of looming in the background is that the last time Palace tried something different was De Boer, and lasted a handful of games. And I believe that Vieira is only the third foreign manager in Palace's history. Attilio Lombardo in 98 was the other one. So this is a very new era for Palace. And as you say, Vieira is a huge figure in English football, but you know, he's nurtured in the City group, in the Manchester City Academy and in New York. Didn't have a great time in Nice. He wasn't the first choice. Lucien Favre made a U-turn at the last minute. But undoubtedly, plenty of intrigue this season in how Palace will fare. I think if you were to ask most Palace fans, they're like excited and terrified in equal measure.
I am terrified for only, honestly, I know it sounds weird and might seem totally off the point, but for a black manager of the reputation of Patrick Vieira in terms of his playing career, you know, a lot has been said about black managers in the top flight. We've argued about a lack of them for so, so long. On paper, in terms of his playing career and reputation, Vieira has it all. You know, he's a World Cup winner, he's a Euros winner, he's a Premier League winning captain. He has the reputation of young players. Lots of them know who Patrick Vieira is to look up to. Fans certainly do. Believe me, when we have this conversation, people still bring up, you know, Paul Lynch's record and John Barnes's record. So if Patrick Vieira is a massive flop, we will be hearing this conversation, particularly in fans, for decades to come. Oh, Patrick Vieira had a chance at Palace. Look how that turned out. So for me as a black football fan, just watching on, you know, my hope and desire that Patrick Vieira just does a steady job, you know, and isn't a De Boer once again, is massive. Like, it's almost fear and trepidation and anxiety more than anything else. So for that reason, I know it sounds perverse that I hope Patrick Vieira does well, but it is one of those things that you know, changes perception. And if he's absolutely dreadful, that perception will continue for a long time, because people love Vieira from his playing days, and they hope and think, many haven't watched him, his team in France, that he will be brilliant as he was as a player. And if that doesn't materialize, like I say, perception changes very quickly. So it's not really a football point as such, but I do hope Patrick Vieira does well. In fact, Nuno Espirito Santo is officially one of our other ethnic minority managers in the Premier League, and he has a huge job on his hands. He's given a 2-year contract at Spurs. We know there's question marks over Harry Kane. It's a huge if he stays at the club for Nuno. You've got Brian Hill from Sevilla, Pierluigi Gallini, the goalkeeper, and defender Christian Romero, both from Atalanta as well. But I, as we said a little bit earlier on, what is it for Tottenham Hotspur that it would mark a successful season? Because whatever it is, I don't know if this team this season will live up to that. Johnny, what do you think?
I think this one comes down to the fit, actually, between Nuno and Spurs, because Nuno's a terrific coach. His history shows you overachievement with smaller teams. And it's built on, I suppose, a reactive, classically Portuguese, Mourinho-ish sort of game, but played probably with a bit more flair, with real extreme pace on the break and real good organisation and on very sort of clever transitions. It's built also on having a very small squad, and he puts a lot of work into the sort of the tightness of a group, the social aspect, all that sort of stuff. And on that kind of underdog thing, now, I'm not sure if any of that really fits where Spurs are at the moment. They've got a slightly kind of fattened squad because of a different managers have signed different players. There's Poch players, there's Jose players, there's other players now coming in from the sporting director. So can he get that tightness? Will Spurs fans enjoy a reactive game? I'm not sure if that fits with the traditions, and then he walks in with this big Harry Kane political saga. And one thing that struck me spending time with Nuno is he's very anti the kind of nonsense and soap opera of football. He likes a quiet life, and I'm not sure he'll enjoy the Kane saga. And then Spurs, you know, the way Spurs a club always attract the sort of the soap opera headlines. They're just one of those clubs that we give a lot of attention to in the media. So there's an aspect there, the fit. I'm just not sure about the fit at this particular time. I don't have any doubts about his coaching abilities. It might be a bit like Benitez. Does he buy himself enough time to make it a Nuno team, and will the fans accept a Nuno team, or are they going to hanker after, you know, the Spurs way or whatever it is, and we'll be where we were, I suppose, with Mourinho after 6 months?
Yeah, I think Johnny's right. I think he's an excellent coach as well. You know, promotion and seventh place finishes with Wolves, that's overachievement. But the fit is awkward. Spurs are a club who they've even tried to court kind of global power and attention, and, you know, signing Bale and hiring Jose Mourinho. For to go from that to kind of to Nuno, who sucks the life out of a press conference, just hates any of the stuff that comes along with management. He just wants to be on the grass, and he's a good man manager too, I think. So, you know, if he can sort of, I don't know, adapt to that a little bit and maybe show a little bit more of himself day to day, I think it could be a success. I think Fabio Paratici as well, the director of football, comes from Juventus. That's interesting, because Spurs started to kind of, well, there just seemed to be too much power in Daniel Levy's hands, particularly with transfers. So, and I think Brian Gill is someone who I've seen little bits of flashes from him and reading bits about him. He's exciting. I think he could be a good signing. really exciting winger. I read somewhere that George Valdano likened him to a Dodgem car. He's one of these kind of left-footed wingers who, you know, just chops and twists and turns, and he loves to run at defenders. So could be an exciting player, but he's only 21. I'm not sure. I think there's a lot of unpredictability about Spurs. I think a Champions League finish is unlikely. I think there will be, you know, on the fringes of the Champions League again. And I think actually, all things considered, that wouldn't be a disastrous season for Spurs.
Yeah, I think that would be an overachievement, actually, if they were sort of fifth or sixth in the Premier League, given how things have gone of late. Finally, though, the unknown quantity in the dugout, Bruno Lage, former Benfica title-winning manager, former assistant to Carlos Carvajal at Sheffield Wednesday and Swansea, has signed a deal to become the Wolves boss, replacing Nuno Espirito Santo. He signed Yerson Mosquera, centre-back, Jose Sarr, a goalkeeper, to replace the one Rui Patricio, who's left. Francisco Trincao from Barcelona on loan. Some of the names in the door at Molineux. Does anyone know what to expect from Bruno Lage? I'm not going to pretend I do.
Not really. It interests me that it's another signer. It's another manager, a bit like Thomas Frank, actually, who has, and maybe Brendan Rodgers, who's actually come really from youth football, from a long period of coaching youth teams. And I don't know, this might be a new route for top managers. Well, it's not a new route. Okay, it's not a new route, but it might be a route that comes into vogue a bit more for management to really, you know, maybe not have the great playing career, but really spend your time in that scenario. Because a lot of football now is about getting value from signings and value from development, and these guys have got that touch. So that looks like the route that Wolves have gone down. The investment has sort of taps been turned off a little bit from Jeff Shi and China, and not that it was ever extravagant, but you know, it was big enough to bring in the Neveses and the Moutinhos. That's sort of, they're going down more of a sort of Moneyball route, cleverer route maybe. They hope, and they're looking for a coach to develop, and that's what Lage's sort of history tells you. He comes with a good reputation, but I'd be lying if I told you that I'd studied Benfica under him particularly closely and could tell you the differences between him and the other 94 Benfica managers in the last decade.
Yeah, it's a very peculiar one. Yeah, he managed the B team. He won the league and then had a disappointing season and left. So he's had really two seasons as a manager, and one of them was a B team. And before that, he was assistant to Carlos Carvajal at Sheffield Wednesday and Swansea. And as Johnny says, worked in youth football. Your guess is as good as mine. it's going to be... one thing we'll say is he's got big shoes to fill. All the things we've just said about Nuno, he took the club on a ride, and all these players, you know, I think there was forged a pretty strong connection with them. So whoever followed them had a tough task on their hands.
I think the one thing that I would say, this is aside from who the manager is and how they might play, the expectation at Wolves has changed very, very, very quickly. You mentioned how well they've done under Nuno Espirito Santo. A lot of their fans were beginning to complain last season about Nuno and the style of play. There are some very good young players at Wolves. It is a long-term project. But remember, you're in the Premier League. And I'm being honest here. If Wolves finish 15th, I would take it right now. You know, it's one of those. You just hope the young players can improve. Some of them get some more confidence. And you look at the long-term picture instead of the short-term picture. So, look, hopefully Wolves do have a good season. Up next, that was the managers, of course. We'll recap the Super Cup in Belfast last night. And we'll see what the Manchester clubs have in store. Stay with the game. Last night in Belfast, Chelsea beat Villarreal 6-5 on penalties after a pretty draining 120 minutes in the European Super Cup in Northern Ireland. Times Tom Roddy, of course, was there. What did you make of the game before we get to the penalty shootout, Tom? It wasn't a classic.
No, it was far from a classic, Hugh. I was thinking heading into this game with Romelu Lukaku flying into London yesterday from Nice. There, it was one of those games where, had it gone the wrong way, it was going to be very easy to discard and forget and just palm off as the sort of a glorified friendly to start the season off. But instead it can be used as a momentum for Tuchel's team, you know, and now they're collecting trophies. And there were kind of positives and negatives from it, in that you watch the first half and they were just utterly dominant over Villarreal. I mean, they had over 81% possession before Ziyech's goal. And they created just so many opportunities, were so dangerous from the wide areas, and didn't really make the most of it. But at the same time, you watched it thinking, well, Lukaku would have attacked these chances a lot more than, say, Werner had, or even Havertz and Ziyech get when they did get into the box. That was what they were missing, and that was what's waiting for them in London now. The negative, really, I mean, Tuchel had said that he wanted the, you know, new players who are coming in to keep the current players on their toes a little bit, and that was happening. You saw this lift in performance from Ziyech and from Havertz. And of course, to see Ziyech walk off with his arm in a sling and Tuchel talk about it as something that looks quite serious, I think winning the game will have made him, you know, forget it a little bit. But they were really quite poor in the second half. All the positive work they'd done was just totally lost, and they allowed Villarreal to come back into it.
Kepa, the goalkeeper, got to exercise some ghosts in the penalty shootout. He was brought on for the shootout, which is, I think, slightly surprising, given it is the European Super Cup, and it's still sort of seen as more of a friendly affair than anything else. Clearly no trust in Mendy to save them, though.
No, I mean, it's possibly this idea of, you know, maybe you look at it as Kepa being the specialist, and sometimes a lot of the time, you know, these statistics don't pay off. But this was something that Tuchel had discussed since February, when they had the FA Cup game against Barnsley, and the numbers said that Kepa was far superior than Mendy at penalties. I think he had saved, his percentage of save rate was 23 compared to Mendy's 8. And that meant that the plan was, even if Mendy played the entire 190 minutes as happened last night, Kepa would be ready to come on to be in goal for the shootout. And of course, it worked. I mean, he made the crucial intervention, and they weren't the best penalties, but it's really good for Kepa. It's a bit of a redemption story, in that his career at Chelsea has been a real disappointment, and the nadir was that night or that afternoon at Wembley for the League Cup final, when Sarri wanted to do the opposite and hook him off to put Caballero on for the penalty shootout against Manchester City. And Kepa said, no, I'm not coming off. And that image of him shaking his head and saying no, and Sarri storming back to his seat as a man who always tended to struggle to hide his emotions, that was the real sort of image, the lasting image, it seemed, would be of his career at Chelsea. But this is a redemption story. And also, you sort of go from here. You go from here, and if Chelsea ever head to a penalty shootout, it's going to be like Tim Krul coming on, isn't it?
Well, just finally, what do you think Chelsea's season will be like as we look ahead to the start of the Premier League campaign?
I'm not entirely sure we will see the sort of true Chelsea until a few weeks into the season, which is the same as, I suppose it's the same as most teams, really. But it's just the added element of players like, you know, Reece James, Mason Mount, Thiago Silva, guys like that who have only been back now for 9 days. That was their first. Thiago Silva's not played a match yet. They've had one in-house match since. So I don't think we're going to see the best of them for a few weeks. But I think with the addition of Lukaku, they are going to be really strong. And personally, without City bringing in a striker, I see them as favourites for the Premier League title.
Brilliant, Tom. Thanks for joining us. I know you've got to shoot off now, maybe to check out or get to the airport. So I appreciate you being with us on the podcast today. Well, let's head from Belfast now to Manchester and speak to the Times' Paul Hurst. Paul, how are you?
Yes, I'm very well, thank you. I think I was in Seville the last time I spoke to you, so this is a bit not quite as warm here.
No, but home is where the heart is, I'm sure. Listen, any foreign football fan that arrives in Manchester is, I think, now going to be massively surprised that the streets aren't paved with gold. The two Manchester clubs, we knew about Manchester United for decades. Manchester City have emerged now. I mean, it's now the home of top-tier talent, isn't it, as a city? Let's start with the red half, Manchester United, because I think there's maybe more intrigue there about their season. A little bit earlier on, we were talking about possible underachievers. And I, you know, I'm a Manchester United fan, but I think there's a possibility they will be seen as underachievers if they don't win a trophy this year. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I agree 100%. I go back to that Europa League final in May, and I thought that was the case then. I thought they underachieved by not winning that. And now they've got a World Cup winning centre-half and, you know, one of the hottest wingers in Europe on the books as well. So there's definitely more pressure, I would say, on Solskjaer to win something this season. You know, he's come so close, hasn't he? Get to finals, semi-finals, quarter-finals, etc. But that's not good enough. I think if you're Manchester United, you keep going around telling everyone that you're the best supporter club in the world. You know, this is where trophies are won, etc. And not win titles. I just think it's they've got to actually start putting silverware in the trophy cabinet again.
Are the club putting any pressure on the manager, though? Because there's one thing for the fans and journalists to think that it's an underachievement. If they finish in the Champions League spot and don't win a trophy again, have you got any concerns over the manager's position?
I still think that Solskjaer would be safe in that scenario. Obviously, depends how far they get in the club competitions again. But they just handed him a new contract, so I think that is the most solid backing you can give a manager, isn't it? And I think that'll give him confidence as well. It'll give clarity to the players who want to come in, and the players who are still on the books as well. So, in terms of the support that the club are giving him, I think that remains absolute.
He wants to play a different style, he says, 4-3-3. Now, I do think that, for me, hinges on having a top-quality holding midfielder if he wants to play with just one deeper, more defensive midfielder, that is. So, will one come through the door, and are you expecting a more attacking, more front-foot, maybe more dominant Manchester United this season?
I don't think United will sign anyone else this summer unless they can move on Jesse Lingard, Pereira, Phil Jones. Unless they can get rid of those players and accumulate, say, 30 million, something like that, then I don't think they'll sign anyone. And you look back over the years, and that's one thing that United haven't been very good at, is getting rid of offloading players. And you know, it's easy to see why, because they give them ridiculously long contracts on huge wages, even if they're not playing. You know, Phil Jones, his contract's until 2023, and he's got an option to stay for another year if the club wants him to. And he's not played. I think it's 18 months he's not played. So he had a poor injury record before his latest injury. So that was a bit of a head scratcher. And Lingard is obviously on big money as well, and he's out of contract in a year, so they're not going to get a big fee from him. But certainly that's what I've been hearing, that United have to sell before they buy again, and they've not been very good at that. So I'd probably say that we're not going to see another new face after Varane signs.
Well, let's move to the Etihad then, the blue side of Manchester. Many people think with the signing of Jack Grealish and possibly Harry Kane as well, this is the team to beat, not just in the Premier League, but possibly the Champions League as well. Where do you see City right now?
I still see them as favourites to win the league this season, particularly if they get Kane. If they get Kane, that is the final piece of the puzzle, really, isn't it? He would he would give them something that they've not got at the moment. I went to Community Shield last weekend and just felt incredibly sorry for Ferran Torres, who was playing up front in his first match. He'd not had any pre-season, and having watched him at the Euros play so well on the right wing, and then he gets shunted into striker's position for Man City and get knocked about by Daniel Amate, who I thought was very good. I just felt really sorry for him because that's not his position. And Gabriel Jesus, you know, Pep argues, has argued in the past that his position is not as a number nine, it's on the left wing. So at the moment, Manchester City don't have a striker. So if you bring Harry Kane into that mix, then you've got the full set. And I just think that would make them the complete team. And it would be a kind of a really mouthwatering prospect watching all those players play together and Kane, you know, finishing off. Because they've got so much creativity. It's just in the last couple of years, they've not had someone who's been scoring up front on a regular basis.
Harry Kane doesn't seem to have a plan B. Do Manchester City have a plan B when it comes to their striker's position? Will they move to someone else if Daniel Levy makes this as hard as we think he might?
From what I've been hearing, I think it's Kane or bust, basically. If they don't get Kane, I don't think they will sign a new striker, another striker, sorry. I can kind of understand the reasoning behind that because they're so desperate, hell-bent on getting Kane in. He is the perfect man for them. So why would you settle for any less? And if you're looking at Erling Haaland's situation next summer, where he's got that release clause in his contract, that you think that City maybe will hang on for another year and go for him next summer. You know, Kylian Mbappe is out of contract next summer as well. So that would be, he's a player that City have looked at in the past as well. So City don't really do stopgap signings. It's never really been a method for the since Cheeky Bagir Stan came in as director of football. So I think if they don't get Kane, I don't think they'll sign anyone else.
Paul, thanks for joining us on the Game Podcast, and I think Manchester will bring home some silverware this season, so plenty to look forward to. So let's get back to Gregor Robertson and Jonathan Northcroft now. On our final point on today's podcast, as we go into the new season, I asked you guys to tell me your headline of the season. One of the big stories you think might happen over the next 10 months. Gregor, I'm going to start with you.
I'm not sure I've got a punchy headline or anything that's like one story. I think, as much as it pains me to say, we just heard Hursty talk about, you know, the expectation in the red half of Manchester. I don't think much is going to change. I think we're going to see a headline where saying Solskjaer tops the table with Manchester United, and then 2 to 3 months later, Solskjaer, you know, pressure rising on Solskjaer facing the axe. I think that cycle is going to continue. I don't think the signing of Varane and Sancho, I don't think it's enough to bridge the gap. And I think that the expectation now is that Manchester United have to challenge for the league. They have to. Well, that's the next step. As you say, they have to be challenged for silverware, but they have to be challenged for the Premier League. And I don't think they're going to be particularly close. So that's, although that's not a punchy headline, sorry, I think it's the same thing we've spoken about for the last year, that there's a cycle and the headlines go from Manchester United being sublime to Manchester United being ridiculous.
Ollie out as a headline could have worked, you know, just...
Yeah, okay, that was good. You could tell, yeah. I've never worked in a newsroom.
I'm just enjoying hearing you say Ollie out. I think there'll be no bigger story than PSG this year. And I'm thinking Pochettino or Poch job as the loser.
See, Johnny's been around, doesn't he? You can tell he's been around a long time.
I'm sorry. You know, he loses Sergio Ramos to a season-long injury. Then he loses Verratti to a long injury. The entire front five refuse to track back and most of them aren't passing to each other. Wijnaldum's knackered and they get eliminated by a very sort of clever Bayern Munich team from the Champions League in the round of 16 and it all blows up. I think that's the way it's going to head at PSG. And it'll be fascinating. What a story it's going to be this year.
My big thing on this is Is anyone going to start watching Liga now because Messi's there?
Probably.
Outside of PSG's games, as in watching the league as a whole. I understand people will watch him, but will people, you know, follow the story of Liga? Or will they just be like, oh, Messi, Neymar and Mbappe are on tonight. Let me watch them score 8 against Nantes.
It's a shame because, I mean, it coincides with Lille being dismantled, doesn't it? And it would have been, if they'd kept that team together and that challenge together, it'd be worth watching. And with Lyon sort of churning players as well, so yeah.
My headline is either Mick Hell or Gunners Go Continental, the pun being Antonio Conte-nental, because I think Mikel Arteta could be the first manager to go. I give him sort of 10 games to prove his worth as Arsenal boss. And if they're like 10th after 10 Premier League games, I think that's it for me. So particularly when it comes to the losses column, if they lose 5 out of the first 10, for example, that's it for me. I think he's probably gone. So Mick Hell might be the early headline, followed by, I think Antonio Conte might take a 2-year deal at Arsenal to see what he can do with that squad. But of course, he'll want a bit of money. But if he was happy to take the Tottenham job, I'm just saying, Arsenal fans, you'd probably expect he'd be happy to manage you. So we'll see if Antonio Conte's back in London. But it's going to be a Premier League season once again to look forward to. Hope the batteries have recharged for all of you. My thanks to Paul Hurst, to Tom Roddy, Gregor Robertson and Jonathan Northcroft for joining me on this episode of The Game, and to you as well. Remember, you can get a subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times right now. You can get 1 month free if you do it today. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We will see you on Monday.